This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. In 1861, Benjamin Webb Baker of Coles County, Illinois, volunteered to serve the Union in the 25th Illinois Regiment of Voluntary Infantry. The letters he wrote home from the field are telling about the war and its impact on one man. Today on the program, we talk with Baker's great-grandson, historian Benson Bobrick. A few years ago, Webb Baker's letters came into Bobrick's hands, and they are the foundation of his new book, Testament, A Soldier's Story of the Civil War. Listeners, I look forward to your questions and comments for Benson Bobrick. Join the discussion with a telephone call. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Benson Bobrick is the author of 9 books, including Wide as the Waters, the story of the English Bible and the revolution it inspired, and Angel in the Whirlwind, the triumph of the American Revolution. Last year, he received the Literature Award of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, which commended him for his work's vividness and power. His new book, Testament, A Soldier's Story of the Civil War, is published by Simon & Schuster. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call if you'd like to join the discussion. Benson Bobrick, thank you so much for joining us this
evening. Well, thank you very much for inviting me to be part of the show.
Yeah, it's so wonderful to read this book and learn this man's story, this man who, you know, is just who lived not far from where I'm sitting, really, you know, just a couple of counties south.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. When I first encountered these letters, I was stunned by their vividness and power, and quite apart from my own family feeling about them and curiosity about my great-grandfather. Before I started the book, I felt I had to satisfy myself that these letters and the story they told were of objective historic interest, and when I did read through them and thought about them for a while, I was sure that was so, and I got to work.
Yeah. Now, as I understand it, these letters were scattered among various family members. How did they come to you back in 1998?
Well, they were mostly sent originally to his mother, and transcripts had been made of them the year after his death by one of his daughters, with a view to seeing them into print, actually. But that project was never realized, so they remained as a treasured family archive in the trunks and desks of various relations for, he died in 1909, for almost 100 years. And in 1998, a second cousin of mine who lives in Roseburg, Oregon, discovering that I was an historian, thought I'd be interested to see them and sent them my way. And, of course, I was much gratified. And I had no idea, actually, that there were so many letters and that they were of the quality and natural eloquence, really, that I found in them.
Yeah, well, our hats off to that second cousin. Whoever he or she may be.
She, her name is Alice Lackey, and she's quite a good researcher and archivist, and yeah. I'm very grateful to her.
Yeah. As a historian and as a great-grandson, what was it like, you know, in your heart and in the pit of your stomach to read these letters?
Well, I had I'd known very little about him. My grandfather had written a little private family memoir in the mid-1960s that alluded to the letters, quoted one of them in full. It gave me a glimpse of who this man was, but in reading the letters, I felt as if I was reading the full story of the common soldier in that war. The letters have such a variety and range in them that and all the emotions that you would think a soldier would experience in the course of 3 years' service, courage, fear often, mm-hmm. rage, frustration, compassion.
Great grief.
Great grief. All of those spring to life vividly from the pages of what he wrote. And as I read them, I felt as if I was getting to know a human being through and through in a way that I could never imagined I'd be privileged to just by reading his correspondence.
Yeah. Let's talk about the history of the Baker family. How did the family come to settle in Illinois and in Coles County?
Well, they had one branch had been originally in Vermont and in other parts of New England, and they had just gone west, as many families did in those days, to try and stake a homestead for themselves. And Webb's parents settled in Coles County, which is more or less in central Illinois. And he grew up on a farm that was about 10 miles away from where Lincoln's own father eventually finally put down roots. And in fact, it was because he was so near to Charleston, the capital of Coles County, that when he was 16, he actually stood in the audience of one of the Lincoln and Douglas debates and had a chance to hear the fundamental issues that were leading up to the war thrashed out. It was quite an experience for him, and I think it helped to shape his convictions.
Yeah. What do you suppose he thought about what was said that day in Charleston?
Well, I think he was raised to believe in that what the Declaration of Independence said, that all men are created equal, was true. And that the issue of slavery, as it had been played out through the course of the 19th century up until that point, was clearly dividing the whole population against itself. And in his own fledgling way, after all, he was 16 when he stood in that audience and 19 when he went off to war, I think he had rather a simple but firm unionist conviction that the majority of the population had to prevail, and the Union had to be held together. Lincoln had been elected. Lincoln wasn't actually at that point in the war at that point in the political process trying to remove slavery from the South, but he didn't want it extended to any other state. And that was Webb's position as he entered the war.
Mm. You write, Illinois was the fractured Union in a mirror, divided in its allegiance north and south by its own sectional slant. In this part of the state, central Illinois, how did the debate over slavery and states' rights play out?
Well, it was very heated. It was really in the central counties that the election was going to be decided in that senatorial election.
1858,
anyway.
Yeah.
Yes. And where Webb was, I think really there was more Southern sentiment on the whole than Northern Unionist sentiment. Most of the population of Coles County at that point had come up from Southern states, Kentucky and Georgia and Tennessee. And so the leanings were really somewhat against Lincoln, but he was also, at the same time, a hometown boy. He'd practiced law in the area, and Coles County had formed part of his circuit as a lawyer, so he was known, and the people were proud of him. But, you know, the issue was hotly debated in its precincts, and I think Webb himself at that point had probably never met any blacks. He was a farm boy. He just believed on principle somehow that what Lincoln was saying, that one person shouldn't live off the sweat and labor of another, was somehow fundamentally true.
Yeah. How did he feel about emancipation when that time came during the war?
Well, it's very interesting. Like Lincoln, I think he started out as a unionist, but not a proponent of abolition. He just didn't know enough about the subject. And really, most people in those days in the North believed that slavery had been founded as part of the constitutional arrangement at the birth of the nation. So it was sanctioned by law, at least in the South. And but as the war wore on, and it became increasingly clear that emancipation was going to be a war aim, he came out on that side of it. And I think he was really exceptional in that way among Union soldiers, because when the Emancipation Proclamation was first set forth, there were riots in many of the Union Army camps and a great deal of desertion and a great deal of discontent, since probably at that point most Union soldiers still felt that they had joined up to preserve the Union, not to abolish slavery. Mm-hmm. But he was a little bit ahead of his time that way. He had, I think, an unusually compassionate heart, but also a somewhat more sophisticated political understanding than you'd expect from a relatively uneducated farm boy of 19.
Yeah. What was his life like as a boy? Did he go to school?
Well, like most farm boys, he went to school briefly during the winter months. Most of his life was taken up with household and farm chores. And this is especially true in his case, because his father had died when he was very young. And he was a big boy, a big, strong lad. And so he took on most of the farm work himself. So it was mostly homeschooling. He had a great uncle and a grandfather who were both in the church. They were ministers. And I think probably it was from them that he learned most of the schooling that he got. Of course, his letters, I correct the spelling and the grammar of them in the book, but they, you know, he couldn't spell, he couldn't punctuate. He certainly had a way with words, but he hadn't really learned the basics of reading and writing in that sense.
Yeah, he's a good storyteller, though.
Very good storyteller, a good sense of drama, and an honest storyteller. He, even in letters back home to his mother, in which he's describing the hardships of camp and the diseases that he's battling, and then later the wounds he receives, some of which are pretty drastic, he doesn't refrain from giving graphic detail. Mm-hmm. At the same time, he's always careful, as a good son would be, to try and reassure her that even though he's going through all this, he's going to come out of it all right. And in fact, you know, he was a very tough guy.
Yeah. One of his brothers was killed in the war, and I cried reading this letter. But he tells his mother in great detail exactly what happened.
Yeah, it's an awful moment in the story for a number of reasons. One is John, his brother, was his only brother, slightly younger, and they were very, very close. And Webb had written letters home at different times urging other members of the town community to join up. He felt that more men were needed. And then when he gets a letter at one point from his brother indicating that he too wants to join, he suddenly tries to dissuade him because there really would be no one else left at home to take care of his grandparents and his mother and the farm and so on. But John is fired up and a patriot and wants to go, and so he joins up anyway, and is shipped in a boxcar to St. Louis. His company receives almost no training before it was mm-hmm. sent into battle at Perryville, Kentucky, and in a bayonet charge, he's cut to pieces on the battlefield. And Webb searches for him after the battle is over, when John doesn't return to his regiment, and finds him on the field and buries him there. It's just a terrible, anguished moment in his life, and I think he felt indirectly responsible in some way for almost having tempted his brother to join, by the letters he'd sent back home that were really meant for others and not for his younger brother to take to heart in that way.
Yeah. Well, also he had some stepbrothers that signed up,
yes,
volunteered, and cousins too.
That's right. I mean, the whole community was involved, and when he writes about the aftermath of the battle and different people that have fallen, it's heartbreaking because he's sending locks of hair home to his mother to give to the parents of fellow soldiers whom he'd grown up with who had died on the field, and it's a community catastrophe every time a battle is fought.
Yeah. His grandfather did not approve. What about his mother, of his signing up and volunteering?
I think his mother didn't want him to go either, because although there's no specific letter that he writes to her explaining why he's going against her wishes, as he does to his grandfather, you can tell by his responses to the letters that she's written to him that she very much fears for him every day and wishes he weren't there.
Do letters he received exist today?
No. Oh. No, you only know the letters that were sent to him by his response to them, although he often gives a very clear idea of mm-hmm. what was sent and what was asked and inquired about, and his mother sends him extra socks at one point when literally he's out of them, and at one point a cake which somehow gets through the lines to share with his company mates and that kind of thing. So there's a picture that you always have of the letters that came into him, but none of the ones that he had received do survive.
Yeah. And he essentially sent home all his pay, or pretty close to
did. I mean, there was very little that he didn't do in self-sacrifice, actually. You know, he knew his family needed money, and although he could have used some of his pay to buy goods at different towns where he was stationed, he was a very good son that way, actually, very, very self-sacrificing and content to live on the worst kind of gruel that the army dished out to him, even though he had quite an appetite.
Yeah. Not enough food, sickness, smallpox, measles, mumps.
Right.
He had a fear of scurvy.
Yes.
I have a number of questions here. How was his unit affected by these things? How did they cope with the diseases they suffered? What were their rations, and how were they equipped?
Well, they were, the rations were pretty poor. The bread was what's called hardtack, was moldy and usually full of weevils and other vermin. They made soup out of bits of grass and other kinds of herbs that could be had. There was occasionally some meat, but sometimes mashed peas served as a substitute for that. But he was pretty resourceful. Actually, he had a good instinct about taking care of himself, and he collected fruits a lot wherever he was and sometimes lived on peaches and apples and so on that clearly did protect him from scurvy and other dietary or vitamin deficiency diseases. But smallpox hit him, and also measles and mumps at a time when children's diseases could kill. And this was particularly, and farm boys were especially vulnerable to them because they had grown up apart from crowded conditions in cities where city kids developed immunities. So he had to face all of that, and long, hard marches through every kind of weather, usually bad weather. But he's always kind of cheerful about it. There's a stoic quality in him which is nothing short of noble, I think, that continually in the reading of the letters astonished me and kept me in awe of who he was. He never really complains. He's just candid about the way things are. But he keeps going.
Yeah, I don't think I'd be up to it.
No,
I know the sicknesses, the the rations being so poor, the uniform situation not exactly terrific, and then being wounded in two different battles.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and
when do you say, hey, it's my turn to go home?
Yeah, he felt, as he says at one point, I don't mind fighting so long as the work, fighting for my country, as long as the work gets done. He hated to sit idle in camp. And actually, one of the things also that made him so sad when his brother joined up was that he felt that John was too frail for camp life. I mean, Webb was a big, hardy farm boy. He knew he was strong and like an ox, really, and tough. John was very slight and didn't have that kind of physical stamina, and so he feared from him. He had a premonition even before John actually signed up.
Yeah. Also, when a soldier was wounded, it was the care that he would receive would be not terrific at all.
No, and this was at a time when antiseptic procedures were really unknown and not to be too graphic. Here, you know, it was at a time when surgeons with the pus from wounds that they had just operated on would, without cleaning off their gloves, would go into another wound and pretend to mend it. And it was a miracle that anyone didn't get a fatal infection from those surgical operations. And Webb was wounded three times, once pretty severely in his left shoulder that pretty much disabled that arm for the rest of his life.
Yeah, he was hit twice in one battle with something called a mini ball.
That's right.
And then later, the more serious injury.
Right. He was shot twice at Pea Ridge, Arkansas,
that's right,
which was the largest battle west of the Mississippi in the war, and then again in the left shoulder at Chickamauga. And the thing about the mini ball was that, unlike modern steel jacketed bullets, which pretty much scour the wound, even as they enter, these spread upon impact, and after tearing through tissue and splintering bone, would tend to lodge where they were, or if they actually passed through you, created such a hole in you that it was an inoperable wound, and so they were an especially deadly bullet that had been perfected by American Army ballistics experts actually just before the war began. The bullet had been invented by a French captain, but the American U.S. Army ballistic experts refined it.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. On the program today, we're talking about the Civil War and one of the soldiers who fought in the Civil War, Benjamin Webb Baker of Coles County, Illinois. In 1861, he volunteered to serve the Union. We're talking this afternoon with Baker's great-grandson, historian Benson Bobrick. A few years ago, Webb Baker's letters came into Bobrick's hands, and they are the foundation of his new book, Testament, A Soldier's Story of the Civil War. Listeners, you can join the conversation this afternoon with your questions and comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area. The number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, it's not long after Pea Ridge. I believe he thinks that the war will wrap up pretty soon, and he'll be home in time for apple harvest in 1862, but that was not to be. How long did he serve, and can give us some idea of the ground that his company, Company E, covered during the war?
Well, he answered one of Lincoln's first calls for volunteers in August 1861. He fought in a number of major engagements, including Pea Ridge, Arkansas, Perryville, Kentucky, Stones River, Tennessee, Chickamauga, Georgia, and marched with Sherman to Atlantis Gates. before he was discharged at the end of August, early September 1864. So he fought almost the whole war through, and he covered, I did compile statistics on this, and I'll just quickly turn to that page in my book, because I don't remember them exactly offhand, but he marched thousands of miles in the course of his service.
Yeah, and they did some traveling by rail.
Yes, by rail
and steamboat.
And by boat as well. Yep. Hold on one second.
That's an amazing thing to think about, covering that amount of ground. So much of it, most of it on foot.
Yes, yes. And he gives some very striking accounts of marches that last for several days, where they march 10, 15, 20 miles a day through blizzards and mud that just sucks at their shoes so much that they seem hardly able to raise their feet and so on, and yet they somehow manage to cover all that ground. It wasn't a war where you could take many breathers in that way, at least certainly not in the war in the West.
Yeah. I'm thinking it's of somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 miles all
I think
told.
It's that, too. Yeah, I was just leafing through. But
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that... I'm sorry. Yes, please go ahead. I'm just,
yeah, okay.
Just checking. Yeah.
He was a stoic fellow. What was the morale of the men he served with? Were they likewise stoic? Were they sort of cut of the same cloth? These boys from
Coles
County? I think
some of them were, and some weren't. He's hardly in service for even a few weeks when he writes home to say that camp life is proving too hard for some of his fellow soldiers. And I think in the course of the war, he was probably more steadfast in his feeling about wanting to stay in and get things done than most soldiers were. That was just his temperament. He was a very steady guy in that way.
Yeah.
But I found the statistics that
sure.
I was looking for, and that was that in the course of his 3 years service, Webb marched 3,000 miles on foot, covered another 1,700 or so by boat and rail, and then also by just mentioning the various battles that he fought in. But yes, he covered an awful lot of ground.
Yeah. One of the critical battles that he was in was the Battle of Perryville, Kentucky. It saved Kentucky for the Union.
Yes.
But it was a horrible, horrible battle. You want to tell us about that battle and its significance?
Well, it did save Kentucky for the Union. It's amazing that it did, because actually Bragg, the Confederate general, could have won it. But the battle took place in such confusion that in the first day of it, the Union army had no idea of the size of the Confederate strength in front of it, and conversely, the Confederate army had no idea that the whole Union army under Buell was in front of it, and so the armies engaged in almost accidental way with completely insufficient information as to each other's strengths and intentions, and the Confederates actually won that first day's fight, but by the evening of that day, Bragg realized through other intelligence that, in fact, his force was no match for the Union force, and he fled. So even though, in effect, the Union Army lost the fighting itself, they won the battle and saved Kentucky.
Oh. And this battle raged for a couple days, yes?
Well, it did, but the second day was more in pursuit of Bragg and in trying to catch him once the Union Army realized that they had the strength that they did by comparison to their opponents. So mm-hmm. it was a weird kind of a battle, as many of the battles in the Civil War were, where they just turned unexpectedly on some circumstance that didn't necessarily justify the outcome.
Yeah. What were some of the other battles that he was in, and how did this is interesting to me because it seems like it's so haphazard that the opponents find one another.
Well, he fought in Stones River, Tennessee, which was a battle which in many ways kept the war going for the Union in that part of the South. In fact, Lincoln wrote after the battle that had the Union forces not prevailed, he could hardly imagine that the Union cause would have been able to continue. It was a pivotal moment, and yet it was in the Western theater of the war, which people who know something about the Civil War, but not too much, tend to think of as a secondary theater to the Eastern theater, where the more famous battles, such as Gettysburg and Tietam, were mm-hmm. fought. And yet, in some ways, really, it was in the Western theater that the war was, if not won, it began to be won there and prepared the way for the massive movements of and decisive movements of troops that Grant marshaled in the East.
Hmm. In the end, how did Webb Baker feel about the war and about what war is? Two different things.
Well, he felt that the war had been a terrible thing. It had been fought to good purpose, but that it had degraded the whole nation by the amount and duration of the slaughter. After all, this was a war which had been predicted to be a short one. I think politicians are always telling the public that a war is going to be short because that's the way they get kids to join up. But this war, in the end, lasted almost 4 years. It involved 2 million men. It killed 600,000 of them in 2,000 engagements. And he lived through a great deal of that. So he felt it had been a terrible thing that it happened. He felt the cause had been just. And he felt afterwards that the way in which the war had gone, which was to ultimately abolish slavery, was the right thing. And he expanded his feeling about that later in his life to include women's suffrage and other causes, so that his idealism in that sense was consistent and ever grew through the war and in its aftermath.
Mm. What was his life like after the war? What did he do when he returned to Illinois?
Well, he thought at first he'd become a machinist. That was his expectation when he was in camp. But, of course, he went back to his farm initially to try and get that going again. But he had a yearning for self-improvement and education, and that burned in him with a bright flame. Actually, even on the march, you can see him reading books on grammar and works of history and other texts to try and enlarge his understanding of things. And so he ultimately left the farm after a few years, went back to school, entered Illinois Normal Teachers College, did very well, and was taken into the faculty right upon his graduation as the principal of the school, and later on became a Methodist minister, and then became very interested as a Methodist educator in higher education, eventually got his doctorate in history, and was president of Missouri Wesleyan. So he rose, he'd come a long way, as I put it at one point, from a soldier just trying to learn his grammar on the march.
Yeah. All the letters are included in the book in an appendix. And before we go, I think I have to ask you to read one or two of them.
Sure.
Share them with the audience here so they get a sense of what we've been talking about, a greater sense, a greater appreciation for the experiences of Webb Baker.
Is there any particular letter you'd like me to read?
Well, the letter where he's writing home to his mother that John has been killed is pretty moving. I don't know if I could read it out loud, but
okay. But
I don't know how you would feel about reading it. It's on page 220.
Right. Yes, this was written from Perryville Battleground, October 11th, 1862. This was 3 days after the battle had taken place. Oh, mother, how can I say it? But I must. John is dead. He was killed on the battlefield on the 8th instant in one of the hottest engagements of the war. He was shot in two places. The balls must have struck him at the same instant. One entered his left side at the waistband and, passing through his heart, came out under his right arm. The other struck him in the neck under the jaw and near the jugular vein and passed up into his brain. Either of the balls would have killed him instantly. He evidently never moved after he fell, nor at all, only to fall, for his arms were as if he had been holding his gun to shoot. I suppose he was at the time the ball struck him. I was on the right side of the battlefield, and he on the left. I did not know that he was on the field at all till the next day. There was only a skirmish on the right, but on the left it was very hot. Crockett Neal, a friend from home, was killed a half mile from the line of battle in the retreat. I suppose a stray ball must have struck him. It went into the back of his head and did not pass through. He fell on his face and apparently never moved. Anthony Cox was killed. Anthony was shot through both legs, just above the knees. The legs were both broken. He was not killed instantly, but doubtless soon bled to death. He must have suffered. He attempted to crawl off the field. He got back about 8 or 10 feet from where he fell. There was an agony look on his face. There were two others of the company killed. I do not know them. Robert Eardsley, John Jones, and Calvin Moore were wounded, and some other of the company whom I do not know. I had permission from Captain Taggart and helped to bury the boys and marked the place. I send you a lock of John's hair. Everything was taken from his pockets but his testament. John died like a man and a soldier at his post and in the front rank. Would I had died in his stead, my only, my true, and noble-hearted brother. What a great vicarious sacrifice our homes and country are costing. How many noble-hearted brothers. I can't write more. God bless and sustain you in this great bereavement. I send Beige Neal a lock of Crockett's hair. Truly your son, Webb.
One wonders how he got through this period, you know?
I think he just... I think he just felt he had to. And he was now the only one left. And yet there's a generosity in him which I so admire, because he a year after after he loses his brother, he's stationed in Winchester, Tennessee, really as an occupying power, and he gets to know the mothers of Southern sons who have gone off to war, and there's one letter that he writes to his mother, who really has been inconsolably sad since John was killed, in which he tries to bring home the enormity of the tragedy that's really befalling everyone. And at the end of the letter, he says, "Please, Ma, don't be despondent. Your trouble is hard, I know, but not so hard as some. I met a widow here who had 5 sons. All went into the Southern Army. 3 of them have been killed, and the other 2 are at Vicksburg." That mm-hmm. just made the hair on the back of my
yeah.
neck stand on end when he said that. And there was... There's such an understanding in the way in which he's describing the reality of it all that could not but move, I think, anyone reading what he has to say.
Yeah. His mother must have been a remarkable woman.
She writes him every week, clearly, and he writes her every week, although the letters don't always get through there. As he says at one point, when she says she hasn't heard from him for a while, he explains that the mails have been intercepted by scouting parties going, you know, both
yeah.
ways. But she does, with all of her heartache, try and keep going herself in the only way she knows how, which is to send him things when she can, like socks or a shirt or a bit of food or whatever she can get through the lines, and just you know, holds out. And
mm-hmm.
I think in that way, true of probably most mothers of soldiers then and now, actually.
Mm. Also, these letters say so much about how it is important to hear from home. I'm thinking of a letter that he wrote to his brother, asking him, "Tell me, please, whether you hug the girls any."
Yes, that's very sweet.
Yeah.
Yes, right. Anything that was particular and personal in that way meant so much to him, and I think every soldier anywhere to keep them feeling as if they were in touch with their lives as a whole, and not just the nightmare that they're living in the field.
Mm. There, we'll leave it. We're out of time. Benson Bobrick, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you. It's been a privilege to talk to you.
You're very welcome. Benson Bobrick's latest book, Testament, A Soldier's Story of the Civil War. It is about Benjamin Webb Baker of Coles County, Illinois, who volunteered to serve the Union in 1861. He served for 3 years, and he lived until 1909, became a very successful man. That's where we leave this portion of the afternoon magazine. Let me tell you, by the way, Testament, A Soldier's Story of the Civil War, is published by Simon & Schuster.